Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. My name is. Oh, that is just not going to work at all. Oh, never accept a dare from Mark Walsh. Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. My name is Leslie Kaminoff, and you may know me as the co-author of the international bestseller, Yoga Anatomy. But I'm also the co-founder of yogaanatomy.net. Now, that's a platform we built 11 years ago where we offer online courses and in-depth anatomy modules that support teachers, teacher trainings, and students all over the world. So that's why we are thrilled to be sponsoring all the incredible sessions here on the Yoga Channel, including my own. And if you feel a connection with the way I teach, I have some great news for you. We are extending scholarships to all members of the Embodiment Conference. And you can find that scholarship info and links to yogaanatomy.net in the description for this presentation and in the show notes. In the meantime, enjoy your body, enjoy your breath, and enjoy your conference. And I'll see you online.
What an awesome video.
It's a cute little sting at the end. Bah, 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 bah.
An excellent way to begin. Okay, so thank you, Morgan, for being here today. I'm very, like I said, I'm very happy to be here, and I'm very excited to see what's going to be an intriguing and interesting presentation. So before we get into that, I'm going to say a couple of words about you, knowing that this is only a very thin description of who you are. So Morgan is originally from New Zealand. He's now based in Spain. He has co-founded numerous yoga and wellness projects, such as Now Here Yoga and Agni Spirit Festival. So we'll put those links in the chat for you. He is currently the director of Amara Valley Eco Retreat, a 100% off-grid center for retreats, trainings, and regenerative culture. And then we're going to put that link in the chat as well. And then finally, his latest research and teaching project is called Antara Flow, which is an intensive neurohacking movement practice combining synergy flow yoga, conscious breathwork, meditation, and binaural beat brainwave entrainment using wireless headphones. And so there you go, and you can fill in all the missing pieces now. Morgan, please take it away.
Thank you, Deirdre. Thank you, Sandra, Maggie. Thanks to Mark Walsh, Daniela, Manal, the whole team, the Embodiment Conference. Thanks to everyone who has been presenting, everyone who's joining. I think this is an extraordinary thing that is happening, and very timely. Filling in the missing pieces, or perhaps painting a broad picture, is what I'd like to do today. And I want to present a lot of different pieces, different concepts, and different bits of knowledge that, when put together like a jigsaw, I think give us a good framework for understanding embodied practice, understanding yoga, and like why it works, and maybe giving us some tools and some language to see the links between different disciplines and practices as a whole. Something I'm finding really interesting, and I think is really valuable about this conference and what's happening, is that there's so many different things are coming together under this kind of big tent of embodiment, whether it's yoga, martial arts, other movement practices. You can be going more into anatomy. There's trauma work, therapy, somatics, social change and activism, like all of these things. And I think it's just incredible that we can start to see how these things can be drawn together and understood with commonalities, because it's been very easy in the modern world that these things become like siloed, little different schools, different lineages, disconnected bits of knowledge or ways of going about things that don't necessarily have that language or that connection to be able to speak to each other. So what I'd like to present today are some ideas that I think are really key for giving us that space that we could all enter into, whether you're coming from a yoga background or from another background, and start to think about, okay, so what are some of the underlying principles that really give us keys to our wellness. And what is wellness? And, you know, how can we define these terms? So the title of this talk was Internal Flow Yoga and the Neurobiology of Wellness. So I'd like to talk a bit about, quite a lot about the body systems that we've got and how they interact, how they interlock, and some of the key things that will help us to kind of unlock the best out of each part so that it fits into the whole. And then also to look at, okay, so in the same way as we might ask, what is wellness? What is flow? What is yoga? We've got answers to these, and the way we language them and the way we define them can, it plays a big part in how we view them and how we go about, you know, interacting with them, how we go about integrating them in our own body, in our practice, maybe our teaching, and then in our wider community of practice and in the way that we're doing now in the conference. So I want to talk first about flow. Flow states have been something that I think have come into more, should we say, mainstream awareness. There's been a lot more research on it since the coming out of the positive psychology movement of looking at, hey, if we're not just looking at pathology in the body, what actually are optimal states? And starting to see that human beings have this innate potential to enter into moments where we feel we lose a sense of ourselves. We feel like time stands still, or maybe it moves very fast, but we're very absorbed in the moment. That we feel a sense of that each moment flows into the next, that our actions flow naturally, that we engage with whatever's going on around us or whatever we're doing in a way that just feels like it's naturally coming out from inside us. And these experiences are highly intrinsically motivating. There's a really interesting book that was kind of collating a lot of research on flow states called Stealing Fire that came out a few years ago. And I highly recommend reading that by Stephen Kotler and Jamie Wheel. And they looked at what are the qualities that that characterize flow states cross cultures and cross disciplines. So not only looking at one kind of thing of like, okay, flow is when you are, hey, you're just like in the moment and it's all about like dancing and music, or that it's only the particular expression that you've got when you're doing yoga. What are the things that come out not just in the West, but all around the world, from indigenous cultures to modern, you know, technological cultures. And the four qualities that they identified were selflessness, timelessness, effortlessness, and richness. As distillations, they're just a way of describing the things that I just said about the flow state. So we have this innate capacity to be able to enter into a state where our inner voice, our inner critic about what's happening, the self-reflexiveness of what we're doing, calms down. Maybe it completely disappears and we're just in the moment with what's happening. That sense of presence is the essence of the yogic experience. The inner voice calming down is citta vritti nirodha, and stilling these fluctuations and modifications of your mind of what actually is in the direct experience of what's happening. Effortlessness was something they identified, where we have like a sweet spot, a Goldilocks zone of stress for our bodies that they can take on. If we're overstimulated by what's happening, or something that we're trying to do is too hard or it's overwhelming to our organism, then we go into defense posture, defense physiology. And I want to talk about how that manifests in the body and then how, so that we can understand how to undo it better. But also, if we're not stimulated enough, we get bored. We don't grow on a physical level, a physiological level. We don't expand our comfort zones. Perhaps we don't expand into greater realization unless there is some kind of stimulus for that. And, you know, in the way that Krishnamacharya would say, perhaps, thank God for dukkha. Thank God for whatever suffering, whatever unease motivates us towards creating connectedness And that connectedness is yoga. We can translate it in different ways. This word yoga that we're using in the same way as embodiment, it's like yoga is a big tent that we're using to describe many different things. So I'd like to talk about, in terms of yoga and flow, that if we think about yoga as connectedness, that's the experience of connectedness. It's the realization that everything is connected, and any practices that take us toward that experience and that realization, we all call yoga. Even though they're quite distinct kind of things, quite distinct concepts, it's useful to see that, okay, so yoga is that which takes us towards understanding and feeling and embodying connectedness. And so when we look at flow states or internal flow in the body, it's deeply intertwined and at its essence is the same as yoga. So I'd like to suggest that when the yogis are talking about yoga and, you know, the ceiling fire people are coming, like, are talking about flow, that we're talking at its most deep thing about the same thing. The thing about what's interesting about this framework of flow states is that it gives you a framework for understanding that there could be links on an internal level of how we experience and how our organism is engaging with sometimes very different activities, because we get this kind of like time stopping, effortless, you know, really rich experience maybe on our yoga mats. But maybe we also get it dancing. Maybe we also get it surfing or doing some kind of sport, or when you're in a group moment where you feel all together. We might get it in a ceremonial context. We might do it just sitting and just being with ourselves in some kind of meditative practice. And just looking at the sheer range of all of those things, it's kind of like it's a spectrum of everything that we're capable of doing could get us engaging in similar ways. And the interesting thing about this research is they've been identifying actually similar things are happening on an internal level in our physiological system and also in terms of our brain waves and what's happening in the brain as a kind of like correlating to the lived experience, the embodied experience of whatever it is that we're doing, even if they're very different. So giving us that sense of, okay, there's this huge range of things that we can do with a body. And our body works best and our experience is richest and most fulfilling when there's this sense of flow, when we're coming home to our essence, as one participant has just put it. It's a beautiful way of saying that. We could ask ourselves, what are the things that would block us from experiencing that state or developing that sense of internal flow? And so the things that block flow and the things that block yoga in the body, I'd like to present. There's a really useful framework coming from the man who's been my main teacher for many years now, and who also presented in the embodiment conference, Simon Borg-Olivier, the founder of Yoga Synergy. And so that is the things that block and diminish our flow and yoga are too much tensing, too much stretching, too much breathing, too much thinking, and too much eating. And so looking at this as a kind of pathways into looking at each different level of the body, I'd like to go through that. So we're gonna go through quite a bit of information. We're gonna try some things out, but probably not be able to go too much in depth into any one thing. We'll have some time for questions. We'll have some time for a little bit of exercises to go, okay, so how does this apply in the body? And just to flag up already that what I'd like to present is that rather than doing too much practice in this session, because I'd like this to be a useful reference for people, knowing that many of you will be watching on a replay for the next 48 hours, or those of you who have accessed the upgrade to the recording packages are going to have this as something that you could come back to and re-engage with the ideas and go over things and maybe re-engage with me at a future date, so that this can be a good reference. We teach online classes daily, Monday to Friday, here from our center in Spain, Amara Valley. And that class starts right after this session. So we're going to put in the chat a link to the Zoom room where we do our online classes. And for anyone who would like to engage with that, we're going to do an hour-long practice where we'll be putting into practice a lot of the things that I'll be talking about, which often we don't have time to express in just the classes. So just to say that already for anyone who would like to join. So if we tense too much, tensing is basically the only thing we do in our lives. We have a body, we have a musculoskeletal system, but activating those muscles is basically the only thing we do because it's either that or relaxing. And everything that we do and experience as a human being, everything that we engage with in the world is basically coming out of that action. I'd like to draw a distinction between tensing and activating. It's a little bit semantic, but I think it's useful to have a sense of, like, if you take your arm and you bend your arm and you move it out, then your bicep is activating, but it doesn't feel like tensing. It's just natural movement. Your arm moves. If when you did this, your bicep was like, whoa, wow, that's a really strong kind of like activation, you know, you feel like it's tensing. Like you can't, if you tense it, you can feel a different kind of thing. Or if your elbow felt like, ah, oh, wow, okay, I'm really working when you bend your arm, then you have a problem with your arm, a problem with your elbow, a problem with your bicep. But when we're activating normally, it feels effortless. It's part of the flow state. Good yoga, hatha yoga, feels with that sense of just total naturalness in the movement. So tensing is when we're overactivating muscles beyond where they actually need to go to bring us into an integrated structure of whatever posture or movement we're trying to engage with. That tensing actually inhibits blood flow through the part of the body that we're over-tensing. So I want to talk about the circulatory system. The circulatory system, it's like the fundamental thing to look at in flow for our body. It's the fundamental system that's keeping us alive, and the most important thing to be cultivating this connectedness, because it's bringing matter, information, energy, nutrients all through the body to every cell, and all of the cells need that. So if you're tensing a muscle more than about a third of its capacity, you start to diminish blood flow through that part of the body. And that could be fine. Actually, it's healthy to do exercise where you're fully contracting a muscle and then fully extending it, as long as you get that range and it's not getting into a habit of chronic tension, which is what happens to hold our posture when we do repetitive movements again and again. And what we see in modern life is breaking people's bodies, because it's putting them either into always kind of linear patterns. We're sitting all day, we're kind of like hunched forward. All of the things that I'm sure everyone is just super familiar with in a context like this, of like what's potentially going wrong in people's bodies and in what we're doing, is that when people are tensing a part of the body chronically, let's say you have chronic shoulder tension and you've got this, a lot of people have this kind of hunched thing, working on computers, this kind of thing. If this muscle is always tense and we know that it's inhibiting circulation, then circulation is not moving through this part of the body. And that means that other parts of the body that are adjacent to it will either be getting diminished blood flow, or the tissues through there will be drying out, nutrients won't be coming to them in the way that they need. And then, if you know, that's the shoulders, that's important because obviously it's really interacting with the arms. But what if there's deep tensions in the diaphragm, in the abdomen, in the muscles around in the hips? And these are like all these parts around our inner organs which deeply need for there to be good flow, good circulation of blood, of nutrients, and also a good flow for taking away metabolic wastes. Otherwise, they build up and eventually cause problems in the body, in our gut, in our digestive system, in all of the organs that we have. So in terms of that tensing, we need to see, okay, so too much tensing will inhibit flow. It's going to actually take us away from a yoga state. And so, fine. So we need to relax more. Well, okay, that's fine. But what we need to find is that balance there. What I've seen a lot of people come into physical yoga practice as that causes problems is that we're trying to do things that are far too complex, far too fast. Beginners are going to classes and they're being told to do how many times Chaturanga Dandasana, upward facing dog, downward facing dog, when they barely maybe can stand, or that their spine is very locked up, that what we've been doing in a well-meaning way, I think, in a lot of expressions of modern postural yoga practice has been trying to identify, okay, hey, here are some maladaptive patterns of tension and holding in the body that are inhibiting circulation, that are causing problems, and then replace them with better patterns of tension. And that's okay. Like, that's obviously better than just having these maladaptive patterns of this kind of thing. But to see that if we're still holding things in a tense way, or we're going about a yoga practice in a way that is over-tensing muscles because we're trying to do things in a very strong way, in this very kind of maybe no pain, no gain, more like an exercise kind of fashion, that actually that's going to take us away from developing this open circulation and open flow in the body that is the essence of the yoga state. The thing about putting all of this into action then is that we've really seen, like, if we understand what actually circulates blood and energy and information through the body, then we can use these systems more intelligently. So when we talk about circulation, most people think that the heart is the primary pump of blood through the body, because that's what we've learned, heart pumps blood. The thing about that is it's one of only at least 10 different pumps that pump the circulation through the body. Then if it was just the heart, blood would really only be getting into this area in the upper chest and the lungs, but it would be much harder for it to get to our toes. And so especially for our extremities, the other muscles in the body act as pumps. So what I said is that the contraction diminishes blood flow, but that extension and expansion draws blood towards that part of the body. So if you take your hand and you make a fist, this is pushing blood flow away from the fist, and it will push it back towards the heart, actually. And then, so if you open your hand, it's white, and then it goes pink again very quickly. But if you expand your hand and open that out, then what you'll see is you're actually drawing blood flow into that part of the body. If you expand your back and open out through here, then you draw blood flow into this part of the body. And if you had an infrared camera, actually, you can see as you expand a part of the body physically, like mechanically, then blood flow will move to that part and more heat will come into that part as blood flows into there. This action then allows us to change our blood flow with our posture. It allows it to change it with muscular activation. And it allows us to realize that actually the actions of the hand. So if not just making a fist or doing this, but actually if we do this, then we pump blood flow through the arm. Maybe you've done this when you've been like getting a blood test or something like this. Every time we walk, every time our calf muscles engage, activate, and then relax and go into this kind of like pumping action, they're acting like the heart in the legs. And this is happening all through the body. This is why it's important to move more. So getting people along to a yoga class and just having more movement than maybe someone who's living a sedentary lifestyle is already really important. It's great. But if we understand this and see, hang on, all of the muscles in the body are engaging with this. We need any muscle that is actually useful needs to be able to activate fully and also relax fully. And that's when you get the best action of this pumping, this musculoskeletal pump through the body. That it's actually when you get the best result from your posture, where you realize that, okay, I'm expanding one part of the body, I'm contracting one part of the body, so blood is going to flow from the contracted part towards the expanded part. When we go into this kind of action, and then perhaps if we're doing dynamic practice, especially so vinyasa yoga, some form of movement practice, that actually every movement that we're doing is helping blood flow around the body, especially if the parts of the body that can be relaxed are relaxed, they're receptive, and the parts of the body that activate can be active. So maybe let's already just do a little bit of movement just to feel that. So if you come up here, if you bring your hands up, then very quickly, you start to feel a sense of tingling and blood flows out. So the musculoskeletal pump is balanced by gravity. The gravitational pump is acting on us all the time. And in the absence of anything, that's what would draw blood flow. So after a few seconds, you can feel, hey, the blood's draining out of the hands, and you could see that they go white. If you bring one hand down, you'll feel the blood flow straight into there. And very quickly, it starts to feel more full of blood. You feel a little flush of warmth. And then if you bring the hands back together quickly, you'll see one is white and one is much pinker. So knowing that gravity is always acting on us, we can then go, okay, so how could we intelligently use this these pumps of our muscles and our posture to move blood flow around the body in a way that's not just kind of like just gravity going on the body, because otherwise we'll only get this downward force, which could be useful if we're doing inversions, but we have to be strong enough to put ourselves in that kind of position. So if we know that making a fist and contracting muscles pushes blood flow away, if you make a fist down the bottom and then you expand out your hand, so these are two different forms of bandha for the wrist and the this co-activation of muscles around the joint complexes here, then what you feel very quickly is there's not the same sense of that everything is just going down. Actually, what you're trying to do here is pump the blood upwards. And if you keep expanding your hand even a little bit actively and pump your hand below, then when you bring them down, they're much more even, and your blood flow has not been as affected in a downward way as going by there. The same thing could happen. I would have to go too far back so that you could see my heels and bring the screen down. But if you just raise your heels up and come down, so you can see my body going up and down, all I'm doing is raising the heels off the floor, coming back down. If you do this a few times, the action of the calf muscles and the actions of the muscles that have to activate in the legs to bring you up and then relax, this pumping pumps blood and circulation up through the legs very quickly. And it's a really quick way of warming the body. If you're in a cooler climate, if you're practicing in a cool room, doing simple things like this, just some repetitive pumping actions, can get the body moving really, really quickly. And that movement of circulation then is what the body needs to have a sense of internal connectedness. I mentioned bandha there. We could do a whole presentation on bandha, and I really recommend that you find out more about Yoga Synergy and Simon's work on bandha as muscular coactivations around all of the joint complexes. Often what's taught are only the spinal bandhas, the Mula bandha, Uddiyana bandha, Jalandhara bandha, but actually we could create bandha on physical, physiological, and energetic levels in every joint complex of the body. And this is like, it's the natural extrapolation of realizing, hang on, everything we do with our muscles is influencing blood and energy flow through the body. So if we make this is bandha, because it's a co-activation of the flexors and the extensors around the wrist, and that's pushing blood flow back towards the core. I can do this, and it's the opposite, but it's also bandha because the flexors and extensors are both activating at the same time. And then we could look at that on every joint complex of the body. And this is what the Hatha yogis were doing and have been doing for thousands of years. Just that this is the way of maybe talking about it in a way that people coming from physiotherapy, people coming from other movement practices, people in the modern world coming from the medical context, we could understand each other in the same way. That stability that we create around our joint complexes and the direction of the movement of circulation and energy through the body gives us a good way of looking at, if I have too much tension in one part of the body, it's going to block things unnecessarily. If I have not enough, then maybe the body can be receptive, but as we just felt, gravity will always be acting on there, and we want blood flow through the whole body. The next thing that blocks this flow is too much stretching. So it's kind of on the opposite side from too much tensing. If we're too aggressive, if we're too tense in our body, if we find the way to ease that up and just move, so you move your joints, all of these kind of things, in the same way as we just did for the calf muscles, moving the shoulders is excellent. And if you do this just a few times, you'll start to feel warmth come through the shoulders, through the upper body. Same thing, circulation is just happening. But if we get into stretching too much, the experience of stretching is counterproductive. So the stretch that we said, so I was giving a really simple example of like bending the arm, that if we bend our arm, actually we lengthen the muscles here. So in the same way as I want to draw a distinction between activating and tensing, the stretching and lengthening are like two sides of the same coin, but one is useful. Our muscles naturally lengthen. Our muscles are elastic. Our muscles and tendons will be able to lengthen out. They'll come back into the same thing. The same is not true of our nerves. And when we experience a stretch, it's not that we're just lengthening the muscles and tendons. So something that you could try here is that if you bring your hand out to the side and you push your shoulder away, so you lengthen out, then we're lengthening through this part of the body. But if you relax your fingers, you don't necessarily feel that much. As soon as you extend the fingers, extend the wrist, and extend the fingertips down towards the floor, you'll notice a very different sensation start to come through the hand, wrist, and forearm. The same thing is happening when we might do our Paschimottanasana. So just to kind of give you a sense of, if you do your Paschimottanasana, this forward bend with your feet, with your toes pointed, then you feel much less stretch along the back of the leg than if you try to pull your toes back, which is often what beginners will do, trying to reach the toes. And the thing is that when you're doing these things, the actual length of the muscles is really not changing very much at all. What's being tensioned are the nerves running along there. So in the Paschimottanasana, the sciatic nerve running along the back of the leg, lengthening or shortening. Here, the brachial and, you know, radial nerves coming out through, down through the arm. And nerves aren't elastic in the way that our muscle tissue is. They can be irritated. What we're tensioning here is actually the insulating myelin sheath around the nerve. And it's useful to do this up to a point, but we have to be more careful than we would even be with our musculoskeletal system. So when we have too much stretching, and there's been a kind of like a bias to this in modern yoga, where sometimes it seems like there's an obsession with stretching as basically that's what yoga is, that the stretch reflex that we feel is when the body interprets, when the nervous system interprets, not the brain, actually, it comes straight from the central nervous system saying, hey, this part of the body is lengthening out too far, too fast, and we need to stop. So we need to contract the muscles around here and put a limit on this. It's your body's natural defense system kicking into gear. And if we're eliciting this again and again and again, we're constantly putting our body into a position where it doesn't feel safe doing what it's doing. If we were to go further in that direction, the body's already signaling, hey, we could experience damage here. The nerves can be irritated much more easily than the muscles, and that can take some time to calm down. We can even potentially damage them permanently if we overdo things. This understanding of the stretch reflex is that if we're having too much stretch response, it's actually when we're taking our body out of safety. And that safety in the nervous system is another key component to our state of internal flow and sense of like centeredness, connection to essence, and therefore yoga. So if we're focusing too much on that, then we need to look at, okay, if we're eliciting this stretch reflex again and again in the body, then what we'll eventually be doing is starting to develop more sympathetic tone. So I'm sure a lot of people who are watching are aware that we have, you know, broadly two really important parts of our nervous system that we need to know. So we have the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system is that which is kind of famously responsible for these responses of fight or flight, or perhaps fight, flight, or freeze. To talk about this in terms of that it's an evolutionary response that our ancestors needed in response to threats to their life. And if our ancestors hadn't had this to some extent, we wouldn't be here today. So it's really important that this happens. This defense physiology kicks into gear. And what happens when we move into a state of sympathetic dominance in our body is the heart rate starts to go up. We get stress hormones in the body, such as cortisol, adrenaline comes in. If we think about the kind of classic conception of this is like if our ancestors had to face a saber-toothed tiger or something like this. So there's a threat to your life. You need to either be able to fight that and survive or run away very quickly. And so anything that is not solely applicable to those things gets diminished in the body. The defense physiology is this. It's protecting our organs. It's the defense posture closes down the back of the neck and the meninges, where information like from the rest of the body is coming through. We don't feel pain as much. There's lots of these stress responses that then inhibit our digestive system, our reproductive system, our immune system. So if we're putting our body into a state of sympathetic tone again and again, we're actually inhibiting and diminishing our body's resources to deal with the inherent systems that are keeping us alive. The way we move, the way we practice, the way we go about putting our bodies in different situations, if we're doing them with too much tensing, too much stretching, very likely that we're putting them into a state of sympathetic resonance. If we're tense in our breathing, too tense around our diaphragm, tense around our abdomen, we'll put ourselves into that more sympathetic state. And this kind of, if there's this fight or flight response, it's once again, it's the body interpreting what we're doing in a way that is a threat, that it has to defend against. And it's taking us away from, it's the opposite of the sense of flow, the sense of effortlessness, the sense of richness that comes from deep safety in the body. And then this gives us the clear kind of physiological framework for talking about trauma, for talking about triggering on physical, physiological, emotional, and mental levels of looking at, okay, how is this changing my body physiology? Is it putting me in a posture that's actually closing me down to that? Or is my yoga practice giving me more capacity, more familiarity, and more ease in going into what actually is the thing that will most open us out into that? And that is the domain of the parasympathetic nervous system, which is when there is safety in the body, that our cells, our organs, our inner bodies use this flow to rest and regenerate deeply. It's when our digestion works. It's when the systems in our body can repair themselves, this cellular repair, that it's the healing state. And so we have to ask ourselves, is whatever we're doing, if we're calling it yoga, if we're calling it some form of practice, is it supporting our bodies as they are from entering into a sense of deep safety, of relaxation, and therefore the ability to regenerate, which they will do if given half a chance, you know, if given the capability and the support to do that. So if we know that, okay, so there's broadly these two parts, you know, there's more complexity to go in there. And I think it's really worth checking out the polyvagal theory of the eminent Dr. Porges, who was also presenting in this conference. How do we know if these parts of our body are in balance? The thing about modern life is a lot of people in the world today are walking around in a state of chronic sympathetic tone and stress that doesn't go away. And it's not how our body organism evolved to deal with things. Eventually, if you're constantly turning off your digestive system, you can't absorb nutrients. You get leaking in the guts, the cell walls start to break down. You can't process the metabolic waste building up in the body. All of these things are going to cause disease. If you're constantly inhibiting your digestive system, our digestive system is where we manufacture 90% of the serotonin in our bodies. So if you're constantly in a state of stress, you're constantly in a state of too much tension around the abdomen, the diaphragm, the pelvic floor, then little wonder if you would struggle to maintain good mood when we start looking at like the body on a neurochemical level of what's happening in the brain. to understand the balance between these things, a key thing to be aware of is that we can actually measure it very well with heart rate variability. So that's not just the heart rate, the number of beats per minute, but actually the amount of variation there is between each heartbeat. And at first, for some people, intuitively, they might think, oh, the more regular your heart is, the better, right? Like the more kind of like boom, boom, boom. But actually, the opposite is true. The higher your heart rate variability, and there's a lot of research in this now in a number of fields to show that it correlates with better health, better sense of internal flow and wellness. And basically what it is it's showing the balance of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems, that one is not completely over-dominating the other. So when the sympathetic nervous system is dominant, you get this like low variation survival mode. But actually what works best for the body is when it's constantly responding to everything going on a chemical level in the body and in you know, the relationship with your environment in terms of what's going on with your psyche, the way your nervous system is interpreting everything that's going on. So seeing heart rate variability, and you can get sensors these days, chest sensors, wrist sensors, there are apps on your phone that you could do it that could help you to assess if something is helping your heart rate variability or not. It's a really key metric to be measuring if you want to start getting into actually understanding what's going on in your body and what's supporting your health and wellness, or what's taking away from it. Because we could, as I say, we could practice yoga, we could exercise in ways that actually diminish, that actually lower our heart rate variability, that actually put us into this defense response on some kind of internal level, that take us away from this internal flow. So with heart rate variability, the things that work best for it are all of the things that actually you would expect could help. So calm, even breathing, natural breathing, where the diaphragm is fully free and able to move in this kind of, you know, there's this dome-shaped muscle that is moving up and down, that there's a sense of concert in the body, of synchronization between the body systems that allows us to go into that. And so what you'll find very quickly is that you can raise the heart rate's variability by stopping, relaxing, and then breathing in and breathing out. And then each different person and body and moment will have maybe an ideal rhythm for breathing. If you practice, there's also, you know, what sometimes known as box breathing, where you breathe in, you hold in a retention, you breathe out, and then you hold. And if you just take a few seconds as I'm talking now to stop and go, okay, I'm just going to come in. And it doesn't have to be that you need to lengthen the breath far, just that ability to come into evenness in the breath already starts to give the body the message that it's okay. We're not in defense. The heart rate variability comes up. We come into a balance on a deep, energetic and nervous system level of the body, a deep physiological, pre-linguistic level of the body. I wanna look at that, because now we're already starting to getting onto breathing, and I'm aware, you know, we're about three quarters of the way through. Is this all making sense? Can I ask, are there any questions coming up that you could either put in the chat or the Q&A box that we could that I could just address now before we get into breathing? Because breathing is a whole piece. Once again, we could spend an entire session just looking at breathing, the physiology of breathing and the mechanics of it, the lived and embodied experience of different forms of breathing are fascinating. And I'd like to just skip on to at least a few. But before then, I'm making all kinds of sense. Great. Yeah, fantastic. It does make sense when you start to break it down. And I think presenting it in the right way of seeing there's all these pieces could seem a bit overwhelming or a bit like bitsy. But if you just put them into the right context, then that's been enormously powerful for me. But also, I think very, very useful for everyone that I have had the pleasure to teach.
And Morgan, we don't have any questions. Oh, wait a second. We do have a question in the question box now. Okay.
Okay.
Are you able to see that, Morgan?
Okay. Well, hey, thank you, Yona. Thank you for that. Right on target. Cool. Well, so let's continue because there's actually a lot more to unfold. So we started to get into it. We've looked at from the physical level, from our posture to our physiology to circulatory system to our nervous system. So we're kind of getting more and more subtle. This is more towards the experience of what we might call the subtle body. And breathing is really the link between what is more energetic and more physical in the body. So I'm already talking about safety, defense physiology, and then and the inherent effects of what this is giving. So if you're breathing, then the way that you breathe correlates with the internal state of the body. And that could be going both ways because everything is connected. If we change our breathing, then it changes the internal physiology of your body, changes how the nervous system is responding to everything that's going on around us or inside us, and vice versa. When we get stressed out, how do we breathe? More shallow, up in the chest, it creates anxiety, and we hyperventilate. We breathe more than normal. The opposite is true when we go into breathing less than normal, but that's actually very difficult. It's the essence of pranayama. The yogis have known this for thousands of years, and they've been practicing that. It's easy for us to breathe too much in our yoga practice, and it's one of the next things that takes us away from yoga and flow. So let's just try that. If you want to try with me, not if it makes you feel uncomfortable or makes you feel dizzy, but let's just do like maybe 10 seconds of breathing too much. So you can just relax for the exhale. And just see how you feel. Keep going with it if you can. So imagine you're really stressed out and you're having this stress response. And how does it make you feel? Really, really quickly. Do you feel more grounded or less grounded? You start to feel tingling. You know, you start to feel like kind of faint. You start to feel dizzy. You can feel that there's a sense of this is the body's stress response. That's putting us into that same sympathetic nervous system tone and putting the body on alert of like, shit, something may be going wrong and I might have to fight, flight, you know, fly, run away or try to freeze or, you know, I might be in danger. And so the opposite is true. We just did like, okay, how about if we bring our breathing into just an easy rhythm? Yeah. If there's a naturalness to that, it's even more powerful when we come into breathing less than normal. So you can feel the effects of like that tingling kind of coming away. Bring your hands onto your belly, onto your lower belly, bring the palm over palm. And really relax. There are some key points in the body which are very important for the conscious mind that we can control consciously, connecting with these unconscious responses of our physiology, of our nervous system, of our inner body, responding with either defense or relaxation. So if you relax your pelvic floor, relax your fingers and your toes, relax your belly under your hands, relax the shoulders down towards the arms, relax your neck, maybe make little movements. You could swallow, relax your throat, relax your jaw a little bit. We hold a lot of tension around the TMJ. Relax the lips. So just relax out there, relax the tongue. You could even let the tip of the tongue, the roof mouth is behind the front teeth. Relax the head, blink the eyes, and just let the breath come down into your hands. So natural breathing is actually very quiet. It's much less than we think. It's how we breathe when we're asleep in the absence of too much tension, how we breathe when we're babies. It's diaphragmatic, so you feel it in your belly. So really relax the belly underneath the hands to give the diaphragm as much space as it wants to just make that gentle pulsation of life that's creating this deep motor of flow in the body. It's another one of the important circulatory pumps for blood. And very quickly, you'll feel that the breath gets quieter and quieter. It becomes more and more effortless. Especially exhalation is completely passive. And it's very relaxing. And as soon as you start to do this, and I recommend if you're going to take on any practice daily, I especially recommend this to beginners when I'm teaching and especially for private sessions, that the first thing you start with is just practicing this every day. It's easier to practice it lying on the floor with your legs bent. You get even more effect out of it, deeply relaxing in the body. And what we do here is when we come to a natural breath, when the diaphragm feels that it's fully free to move, when we're breathing less rather than more, the body comes back into that parasympathetic rest and regenerate state. It comes back into a state of balance. And you can feel in your body and your being, in your mind state, that everything just comes down to rest again. And it's the opposite of the hyperventilation. Hyperventilation, breathing more than normal, has its uses. The Wim Hof method has become very popular in the modern world. And it's using both, and actually in concert, if they balance each other, breathing more than normal for some time, but then breathing less than normal, going into deep breath holds, can be really useful. It's deeply nourishing in the body. And the reason for that is that as we breathe less, CO2 builds up in the body. And you might have even gone to a yoga class where they're telling you to like breathe out more and breathe very intensively to try to, as if CO2 was this waste gas we have to get out of us. The opposite is true. It doesn't make sense when you look at the breath physiology. CO2 is, it's one of the most important things for opening up the breath's effect in terms of opening a sense of safety. When CO2 builds up in the body, our blood vessels open and it enhances circulation in the body. So when we hyperventilated before, the opposite true, we blew off the carbon dioxide and the blood vessels kind of seize up and our circulation restricts. So there's like chemical reasons and a chemical pump in the body for the circulation. That is also why this is taking us away from a state of flow and a state of yoga. So in terms of understanding that, then the direction of our practice can be towards hyperventilation, towards breathing less than normal. And this is going to have effects on our physical body of helping relax, on the physiological body in terms of enhancing circulation, in terms of helping nervous system tone, that balance in between these different parts of our nervous system. And then, as I said before, you could already feel your mind state, your thoughts actually relax down. You'll find deeper clarity and stillness in the mind going into breath holds, going in practicing kumbhaka, which is the essence of the pranayama that the yogis have been doing for thousands of years. And we're missing if we're breathing more than we need to. And it's easy to do that in modern yoga practice. There seems to sometimes be an obsession with it. The thing about what happens then in the body is all of this is moving towards us understanding what's happening in our brain. And I want to spend this last minute just giving a few little things about, we know more about our brainwaves now than ever. Our brainwaves exist in different states and different levels. We have gamma, beta, alpha, theta, and delta, and epsilon waves, and in increasing kind of orders from high to low. Most of our waking state mind is in beta waves, but when we come into deeper levels of concentration, and especially relaxed concentration or concentrated relaxation, both of which could be good functional definitions for meditation, then we start to come down into alpha waves. Brain waves become more coherent. The deeper we go into that, the deeper towards sleep or towards deep meditation that we go, they come towards these theta waves. And right about where alpha waves and theta waves, so that's between eight, alpha waves are between 8 and 12 hertz, theta waves between about 4 and 8. Right about that crossover point between alpha and theta is where they've started to see it cropping up again and again in research that we enter into flow states more readily. And not just flow states in like seated meditation, but sometimes in movement, sometimes even doing things that are very, very intensely physical, we could be getting this coherence in our brain waves. And it could be anything from that to making love to our yoga practice. When we see this state in the body, we know that on a very deep level, we're already entering into that. And the last thing I'd like to say about that is that right about that level, around 8 hertz, I find really interesting, and it's what I use in the Antara flow practice that I've been developing for the last 2 years, where we use binaural beats, special audio that brings the brainwaves into a certain frequency. And the thing is that that frequency at 7.83 hertz is what's known as the Schumann resonance. It's right about that level where alpha and theta cohere and crossover and we experience flow states. It's also the frequency of the magnetic resonance of the Earth's magnetic field. And that might be a coincidence, but I'm not sure that it is. This is a field that has been guiding evolution, the evolution of the biosphere. It's been guiding our our bodies, all of our lives. And if we come down into that frequency and help to stimulate and cohere our brainwaves around that point, we go into flow states more readily. And so we start to see everything around us, from our relationship with our environment to the evolutionary heritage that we're having, to our genetics in you know, our epigenetic response to the moment, and all of our practices on physical, physiological, phenomenological, and mental levels, all help us cohere towards all of the good things actually go together. And this is whether we're doing yoga or movement or meditation or therapy, whatever it might be, I think we can start to see a coherent framework coming in for understanding what actually works for wellness. And that wellness is when all of these parts of any whole are coming together in loving relationship. In our body, the cells in our body, the organs in our body coming together, all of us coming together as a society in loving relationship. That's wellness on every level.
Thank you so much, Morgan. I really don't want to interrupt, but I really...
Yeah, sorry, but we need to end.
I can listen to this, and I'm sure other people could listen to this for several hours. Thank you so, so much. This is a very rich learning experience for all. I have my notes. I'm not just hosting. I'm actually learning on a deep level. I've never thought about my blood when doing a yoga class. So the next time
I do... It's really important.
Now I feel that on a deep level. So thank you for that learning.
And it's all like music, says Yona. Wow.
You said concert many times, orchestra, just so beautiful. Thank you for taking us into that deep exploration. Just to finish off here now, and I am going to ask for your tip in a moment, Morgan, so make sure you've got that ready. Thank you, everybody. Thank you to Morgan. And I know that Sandra has already placed in the chat some of the links, or all of the links, I would imagine, for the coffee break, the Facebook group, the websites of Morgan and all of his various projects. We also want to remind you about the library. If you've enjoyed this, if you've enjoyed the conference and you're able to, please remember that you can upgrade. And upgrading provides you or gives you all of these beautiful workshops, you know, forever, essentially. So please do that if you have the means to. And also by doing that, we're able to hold this and we're able to host it and make it accessible for many people too. So please do that. And I think the link is in the chat as well for the upgrading. So gratitude to you, Morgan, gratitude to the community for being here, and also gratitude to the conference team. And Morgan, now is your time for your embodiment tip, your top tip.
So I thought a lot about the top tip of like, any of the points that we made about could be applied to yoga practice. The practice we're going to do now, for anyone who wants to tune in, I think the link has also been there in the chat. We're going to be applying all of this. But actually what my top tip is, coming out of all of this understanding and this framework for seeing everything holistically, is don't be afraid of your own vulnerability. Don't be afraid of feeling into discomfort or even pain, because it's that sensitivity, that gentle awareness that is the essence of ahimsa, is the foundation of yoga. It's that which is going to bring you into a fuller understanding of what actually supports your wellness, of what actually supports the loving relationship of the whole. To whatever extent we're in defense to the feels, parts of ourselves that feel weak or feel painful, that we're trying to protect around them, we divert an enormous amount of energy into that, we create blockage around that, and we divert all of our attention into trying to strengthen our strong points, takes away from actually realizing the endless nurturing source of energy that comes from acceptance, embracing, nurturing, and healing of the whole. So all of this is really just pointing to all of the things that I'm sure are coming out in all of the channels in the Embodiment Conference, which is like, let's be really open and honest and relax and release into, to embrace the wholeness of our being as human beings, not be afraid of our vulnerability, and allow that to inform how we all grow together.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. And just to let you know that the next session on the yoga channel is going to be a restorative yoga practice, if you're interested in that. That's coming up in an hour. Thank you, Morgan. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Thanks to the whole TEC team. Thank you to the Embodiment Conference. Thank you to all of my teachers, Simon Borg, Olivia, Mark, Everyone who's been there along the way, thanks to my mom and dad. I just want to say also thank you to all of you for joining in, whether you're here in presence or on a replay. Let's keep this healing energy opening out into the world.
Yes, thank you.